Welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference. This is one of five nutrition case studies. I'm Helen Lynham and I'm joined today by Claire Sehinson and Sanna Anderson, nutritional therapists as part of the Optimum Health Clinic team. With these case studies, we aim to discuss the clinical practicalities and the realities of consultations and the therapeutic process. We hope that through these, we're going to help practitioners and clients alike. What we're going to do is share some functional matrices of real cases and also some real test results. And through those, hopefully give a perspective on the timescales involved, client sensitivities along the way, and the real challenges that clients actually face trying to apply our suggestions. These kinds of things are rarely touched on in textbooks or on courses. And so this is something hopefully that's quite new. The good news is that actually three of the Optimum Health Clinic team have been involved in an international case study book coming out at the end of the year. And one of them is actually the editor. So we're very excited and proud of that too. So for this discussion with Claire and Sanna, we're going to be looking at two cases that ended up being SIBO cases, small intestine bacterial overgrowth, but they weren't actually obvious. And so we're going to share our investigative journey and of course the actions we took and the actions and the current situation of the client now. So first of all, Sanna, let's start with you. If you bear with me, I'm going to pull up the actual matrix so that you can see that if I share my screen. And talk us through this client.
Hi, thank you. Yes, so we are talking about a female client in her 50s. She came to me presenting with diagnosed chronic fatigue syndrome. Her main symptom in this case was constant tiredness that she said wasn't really shifting or being positively affected by anything that she was trying to do or not to do. She had always led a very, very busy life. She was physically very active prior to getting ill. She had physically very demanding hobbies. When we looked at her health history, starting from childhood, there really wasn't anything there yet to indicate any sort of concerns or worries. She had a healthy childhood, no obvious familial risks in terms of health. The build-up to the chronic fatigue diagnosis really started slowly by, you know, stresses of young children, very, very busy life, demanding work, very physically demanding hobbies, gradually energy reducing. Then she went through quite a challenging, emotionally challenging time in her life with divorce, deaths of a couple of very close family members at close succession. And I think at that point, she felt the tiredness started to really impact her day-to-day life. She did go to see her GP, and at some point, a diagnosis of underactive thyroid was made, and prescription of thyroxine was given to her, which sort of gave her a bit of a boost, but that didn't really last. She was complaining that she really had to narrow down her life to very, very little activity. She managed to work part-time and then that was very much it. No more hobbies. She was now complaining about constant dizziness, to which no sort of particular cause was found. Brain fog was increasing. At this point, her digestive symptoms, as we are talking about SIBO, but at this point, really the only symptoms that she was complaining about were nausea if she wasn't eating regularly. She was a little bit constipated, had eliminated red meat from her diet because she found that she was struggling with that. But that's where we started, basically.
And interesting, yeah, at this stage, nothing really much to indicate that gut was an issue, you know, nothing more than probably most people would have. So where did you start with her? What did you think would be a good place to start?
Well, as we were sort of pulling the history together with her, we really identified that the one kind of clue that really was there along the way was stress in various different shapes and forms, you know, physiological stress. She admitted that she was the type of person who would really push herself beyond the sort of comfortable boundaries, I suppose, physically, plus the fact that, yeah, she accepted that if she had to identify the sort of tipping point, which in this case there really sort of wasn't a clear one, like sometimes you see infection or one particular event where clients identify that, you know, life was sort of okay before and then, you know, nothing's been sane since. But she felt that, yes, the emotional stressors that took place in quite close succession, she felt, yeah, that probably was a turning point. And the fact that there was that endocrine involvement of, you know, diagnosis of underactive thyroid, we felt that the endocrine axis would be the place to start.
Absolutely.
And also wanted to therefore look at her adrenal function and cortisol output and see how much of a role that might have had in her.
And also worth pointing out, of course, you would have done all of the nutrition stuff as well, getting in more protein and more fruit and veg and talking about the whole caffeine thing as well, which we take for granted, but we do every time because it's the baseline of what we do.
I know. Yes, I mean, absolutely. There were signs of poor blood sugar control. We talked about protein, which of course is challenging if you then have some digestive challenges as well. But really at this point, my major concern with the digestion was that perhaps the long-term stress would have suppressed her digestive output to a level where she was just struggling with, you know, higher fiber diet perhaps, or, you know, denser sources of protein. And in fact, that initial support of digestive enzymes and hydrochloric acid, the client found incredibly helpful. And we didn't really touch upon digestion for a few more consultations because we felt
no need.
Yeah.
Well, let's look at a very different case then. We're going to pause your case for a minute, Sana, and switch over to Claire's case. And Claire, if I share the functional matrix for yours, I think it's fair to say that with this one, actually, the whole area of the gut probably did seem to be more significant to start off with. But yeah, talk to us about the whole picture to start off with. Because obviously we don't just work with the gut, we're looking at the whole picture and we're just going into that area for the sake of this discussion.
Absolutely. So my client did have a more obvious gastrointestinal presentation from the outset. However, her initial goals were to address her chronic fatigue at ME. So she had a lot of chronic and prolonged sort of viral infections, and her ME onset was a notable viral and sort of post-flu trigger. She had multiple allergies, including oral allergy syndrome, which sort of a tingling, swelling of lips to certain raw fruits. She'd noticed food intolerances to dairy and gluten in the past, but any reintroductions also flared up symptoms again. She had some chronic nasal congestion and, as she phrased it, an unsettled stomach. So, you know, IBS wasn't on the forefront of her mind either when coming to our clinic. But more for questioning, she did have quite severe IBS. A range of symptoms were diarrhea, sort of not the classic postprandial symptoms that you typically get with SIBO. It wasn't the first thing that came to mind. She did have morning urgency and nausea, and that would be triggered off by, you know, just drinking water, so not even with food. Abdominal bloating and cramping, flatulence, heartburn, sort of yellow malodorous stools. And she had two clear instances of gastrointestinal bugs. So one was from drinking contaminated water while camping, and another one was when she contracted when travelling. And she'd had the NHS full gastroenterology workup, so endoscopies, biopsies, stool tests, bloods, and it was all found to be normal. So she was a young professional, high academic achiever, so a lot of stress in her job and her sort of approach to life, if you like. Some quite difficult personal relationships going on at the time, so stress was a big part of her picture too. She was still in work, struggling the hours, and she was on a vegetarian diet. So we're going to touch on that a bit later, but that can be quite challenging when it comes to working with the gut and working with SIBO, and she was fairly reliant on convenience foods as well, and stimulants, so caffeine was in her diet.
And in all fairness, if she's trying to sort of hold down a job a little bit, like with Sunners as well, yeah, when you're not well and you're trying all you can do just to make ends meet, yeah, by working, and you've got no energy for anything else outside of that.
Food preparation, it's sort of a normal thing to rely on, and it's keeping you afloat, yeah, and keeping her just about ticking over. So, you know, yeah, we wanted to work with that as closely as possible and not, you know, give her too much of a challenge that would actually make her worse.
Yeah.
She also had quite significant depression, anxiety, and seasonal affective disorder that did affect her on a day-to-day basis. There was, you know, typically with a lot of our clients, there was a multiple chemical sensitivity, alcohol intolerance, and a lot of migraines, and that seemed to be linked to her menstrual cycle. She did have some background PMS as well. She was taking citalopram and thyroxine, so later on we'll discuss, you know, citalopram does interact with some of the SIBO formulations, so that was another sort of challenge that we had to work with. And her initial blood work showed low B12, low iron, which is fairly common on a vegetarian diet, so there were some frank deficiencies from the outset, low vitamin D as well, and high eosinophils, which are related to or associated with an allergic response, so we were working with that from the outset. And one of the things she did want to address was a painful intercourse, which appeared to be due to frequent thrush. There was a history of a lot of antibiotic use and antifungal use, but it hadn't really kept the infections at bay, so she was kind of struggling with poor immunity as well.
Great, I think that paints a picture of a lady struggling, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, thank you, thanks. So we're not going to share any test results at this stage, but perhaps you'd just like to say where you thought at this point you would start off.
So due to the limited finances as well and some really obvious frank nutritional deficiencies, we decided to just do the basic diet work, replenish her nutritional deficiencies, and then watch for changes in her symptoms before deciding which functional system to explore, because at that point it did look like every system was down. She did improve really significantly to some of the basic blood sugar balancing and optimizing protein intake and repleting those nutrients.
But not completely.
Not completely, no. So we trialled DIM as well, and that seemed to significantly reduce her migraines. She found the gluten, dairy and sugar-free diet really helped settle her gut, but any reintroduction of it did flare up her symptoms again. So it was obvious that something underlying had not been sorted. Her gut did quiet down quite significantly with some basic digestive support, so primarily it was just enzymes at this stage. But she did have periodic diarrhea and vomiting episodes, which would occur for no apparent reason. And at this stage, we weren't really sure if it mapped onto hormone cycle or coincided with episodes of stress and a viral infection, or if it, you know, mapped onto a life cycle of a parasite. So we sort of knew we're probably going to be looking at the guts at this stage.
Great, thank you. So Sana, let's go back to your client then. So you started off doing an adrenal test, didn't you?
Yes, so we just chose the simple salivary cortisol output test just to really get a bit more of a baseline of what we were going to be looking at, whether there was some potential adrenal insufficiency that was contributing to her overall picture. I mean, I think probably as everyone knows, CFS is a very complex combination of factors usually that then makes up that final presentation that you end up with. But, you know, as we had already agreed, both myself and the client, that stress was sort of one of the key words, if you like, on the table. And we thought, well, you know, that would be a good place to start. And yeah, as you can see from the results, to me, this sort of picture would definitely be showing some level of adrenal insufficiency, sort of lack of almost, you know, buffering capacity throughout the day in terms of cortisol output. And indeed, we then, you know, followed up these results with some herbal adrenal support, continued with all the other kind of foundational areas, which, just blood sugar balancing, taking any stressors away that we could control. Obviously, you can't always control sort of your emotional
life,
life and, you know, other factors, but as much as we could, her sleep had...
I think, just going back to that, I think that's a really important point because, you know, as nutritional therapists, I often say to people, what our aim is, you know, particularly with dietary changes and things like that, the last thing we want to do is to add to someone's stress load, because almost always someone with chronic fatigue has got stress at some point because their body is out of balance. So there's the emotional stress of the illness, and physically something is not right. And so we don't want to be adding to that, and but we also, so we're trying to control, so the blood sugar control and getting the nutrients into the diet. If they're not right, they're stressors. If they are right, it's a stress that's gone. It's, you know, it's another load that's gone out of the boat. So that's always helpful.
I completely agree. And I think, and that's the sort of, I think, the lovely two-way conversation, you know, very helpful and useful two-way conversation you need to have with clients is to make sure that the changes that we are implementing are still doable. And I think, you know, in her case, you know, again, with hindsight, I think, yes, we did start quite nicely in terms of building things up. And she did, as I said, you know, as we are sort of referring, keep referring to the digestive side of things as well, she felt things did improve just by supporting digestive function with enzymes. She did eliminate gluten. She had dabbled with a sort of reducing gluten in her diet previously because she had noticed that bread did increase some of her sort of digestive symptoms, particularly bloating. But, you know, completely eliminating gluten, again, she felt that was a really positive step. She was able to do that. And again, well, at this point, as we were sort of reviewing her progress, felt, okay, we're quite happy with what we've done with digestion. The adrenal supplementation was starting to give her a bit of a lift. So again, felt that this was, you know, this was a connection that we had sort of correctly identified at this point.
But it sounds like she wasn't there completely.
She wasn't,
which is often the case, isn't it? The adrenals, it's a great extra piece of information. Yeah. It's a layer down from the initial presentation, but rarely the whole story. In fact, I don't think from a chronic fatigue point of view, it's never the whole story because there's so many other things going on. So what made you start to think about SIBO being the issue with this lady? Because there's, I'm intrigued as to what was the seed in your mind? Where did that come from?
Well, I think you have to sort of, exactly like you said, you kind of continue that process of peeling the layers back and seeing what sort of comes up next, almost, if you like. And so in timescales, this would have taken place probably over at least two to three follow-up consultations where, you know, as I was saying, made some progress, but what was starting to emerge, and sometimes this is something that I feel only time will kind of bring up, you know, and make obvious, and that's the beauty of sort of being able to go back then and start making those connections. The things that the client was still at this point complaining about, despite some improvements in her energy, were she still had ongoing sort of facial puffiness, which I didn't really mention at the start, but you can see it on the matrix, that we hadn't really done, you know, nothing had really changed that situation. When she was having one of her sort of crashes or downturns, there was often a headache involved. She did start saying, well, look, every time I sort of do crash or take turn for the worse, my digestion tends to go a little bit off plan as well. Certainly the first few times she mentioned it, she was very adamant that sort of there was first something else and then the digestion followed. So again, we felt at this point it wasn't necessarily leading, but because there was headaches involved, the puffiness, histamine sort of became something that we thought, well, that would be worth investigating. And she did indeed connect a few sort of high histamine foods as being triggers for her headaches, which somewhat improved by elimination of those, but still that sort of fluctuation continued.
And the histamine is just another symptom, isn't it? We've got a great recording where we talk in quite a lot of depth about histamine, but it's just another symptom. We've still got to get to what's causing that.
If you've got high histamine, why is it? You know, just eliminating the food is really just putting a patch on that.
It's a start point, but it brings relief, but it's not that you can't carry on the rest of your life like that. Ideally, you want to get to the cause.
And I think actually it was sort of as we were then together sort of reading through her notes and saying, okay, well, what has happened? You know, what have we done so far? What has been positive? You know, what have we tried that sort of potentially done not a lot in terms of improving symptoms? It really was those digestive symptoms that just kept jumping up. And although still at this point, really, she wasn't overtly sort of daily suffering from digestive distress, any bloating, burping.
But isn't it interesting though, we don't know what normal is because we only ever have our own experience. And I think that's part of the issue, isn't it? And even as practitioners, as we try and inquire, you can share the Bristol Stool Index, you know, you can ask about bloating. But you know, some people are bloated without even realizing it. Yes, you've got that extreme bloating when people can go from a flat stomach in the morning to 6 months pregnant by the end of the day. That's extreme. Not everyone gets that level of bloating. And if you're eating in a way that promotes the SIBO all of the time, the bloating is always there. So you don't, you just don't know.
No, so it becomes your new normal.
So let me share your test results that you did with this lady so that we can just briefly see them. So there we go. Those were the results.
There we go.
Exactly. Perhaps for those people who might not have seen these test results before, would you say that they're a positive test?
I would say that's a very clear hydrogen producing bacteria, you know, positive for hydrogen.
So hydrogen is the blue line, which goes up like that.
So you can see a very nice, nice peak there at, I think that's at 80 minutes.
And the SIBO test looks for two different types of gases. And methane is the other gas, and that's trundling along at the bottom here, not really an issue for this lady. And then you've got the green is the combined. So absolutely, that was that was a test worth doing, wasn't it?
So that was, well, but even at this point, I mean, I'd like to say, well, this was our sort of eureka moment, but I mean, of course, still at this point, well, it's positive, but you know, how much of a contribution is this result now making to the overall picture? You only really find out once you start sort of dealing with the
Exactly. Brilliant, thank you. So why don't we now have a look at your client Claire? We've got quite a few tests to run through for her, so to start off with, you've talked us through sort of the dietary stuff and things that you did which made some difference. And I've just realised I've got a problem with the results. So start talking through and give me a minute to just do some work on them.
So yes, we obviously wanted to investigate her gastrointestinal system. We picked stool over SIBO breath test because back then, you know, this was a few years ago, maybe 3 years ago, whilst SIBO is hugely fashionable at the moment, there wasn't the reliable lactulose 3-hour breath testing and prep instructions that we know, you know, produce that reliable result these days. So traditionally we'd go in with a good PCR stool test to capture as many digestive markers as possible that we could take clinical actions from. So it's important that the test showed something that we could work on. And secondly, her SIBO symptoms weren't obvious from the start. She did have the post-infectious IBS, which was, you know, indicative of some possibly SIBO, but she was waking up with nausea and morning urgency, which, you know, wasn't typically your SIBO symptom. So we started with this PCR stool analysis. Perfect. So this is her first stool analysis. It did show parasites, which we'd we thought that might have been the case given the contaminated water consumption. So she was carrying Blastocystis hominis, Dyens amoeba fragilis, and a gut inflammation marker, isoniform protein X, which is quite a reliable marker in the store of IBD, or inflammatory bowel disease, particularly associated with some sort of allergic response. So this could be from food intolerances, it could be from carrying parasites or helminth worms. There was also digestive insufficiency, so she had low short chain fatty acids and butyrate, which had been much needed for colonic health, and there's low bacterial diversity in the large intestine. So this wasn't someone that looked like a typical stool test placebo, because often you do see high bacterial overgrowth. So it's not something we suspected from the outset. We did start her on our herbal antimicrobial protocols, or antiparasitic herbs, which she reacted quite adversely to.
Give an example of what you did use?
So I think combinations from berberine, obviously we know now berberine is also a SIBO hydrogen effective herb. There would have been possibly oregano, grapefruit, such combinations. So she did feel quite dizzy and sick, and she actually needed to be signed off work. Because of her reaction. So there's a huge Herxheimer or die-off effect, quite a toxic effect from taking these antimicrobials. We persisted with lowered doses and some assisted detox and elimination support, which marginally helped, but she still felt pretty rough on them. And if you want to bring up the retest, I just show the first page of the retest.
Yeah, I'm just doing some work on it now.
Okay.
Deleted it. Didn't mean to. Sorry.
That's fine. So
joys of live. Well, it's not live, but yeah, trying to do this. I will bring it up in a second. Oh no, I think I've completely lost it. I'm sorry.
That's okay. So the retest did show that the digestive elements had improved. Her short chain fatty acids were much better. So her diversity was fine. The gut inflammation was possibly worse. So it was high level of isoniform protein X, and the parasites were still there. So they'd obviously been quite resistant to the eradication. It suggested we triggered sort of an allergic response with the protocol we used. So after a period of sort of leaving her gut alone and stabilisation, just following her same dietary advice, obviously working with the same protocol with her hormones, she felt well enough to get back to full time work. So she took a hiatus from nutrition for about a year. Over that year, she returned a year later with actually a view to support fertility. She wanted to look into supporting herself nutritionally whilst reducing her antidepressant with the help of her GP. And she wanted to support her immune system. So there's still no mention of really focusing on the gut. But obviously with all of those things she wanted to do, we decided to check if her the parasites still there, there's digestive inflammation. And we picked a different stool analysis. Again, finances were still a consideration. So we picked something which encapsulated, different viruses, zonulin, which is a...
I can bring this one up, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give you a second.
I had it a minute ago. There we go. That's the one.
Well, it's quite a few pages to scroll through. But we picked it because we wanted to rule out H. pylori as well. We wanted to have a look at zonulin in case there was intestinal permeability that kind of contributed to her allergies. Perfect.
There we are. So
brilliant. So we chose a stool test. It did show high clostridium, high level of firmicutes, but also low levels of normal bacterial flora. Candida and Candida albicans were elevated, which did sort of back up why she did have a pretty suppressed immune system and chronic thrush infections. And she'd had taken several courses of antibiotics in that interim. Blastocystis was still there, diatomeba was still there, so parasitic overgrowth was still high. There was low elastase, so it's a pancreatic output, and low gut immunity, which is a secretory IgA marker. And we can see some of the inflammatory, the bowel inflammation markers were not elevated, so they're within range.
It's interesting though, isn't it? That she had thought that she was fairly well. She hadn't come because of this.
Her the ME that she came to see us with was, you know, significantly more manageable. And she sort of came to address different symptoms, but it was taking it back to the gut, because if your immune system is terrible and you're catching a reinfection going, we often see Candida as an opportunistic infection. So it's not the root cause. It's a sign that your immune system is pretty low. So that was 70% of your immune system being in the gut. It was the sort of discussion we had about investigating the gut again to see if we could make an impact. She tried lots of immune supplements, self-prescribed echinacea and all of those things. They didn't make a difference. So we decided to take a different approach. So from this outset, we decided to do some gentle parasitic work. But I asked her at this stage, because of finances and we couldn't launch straight into another test, if she would consider doing the FODMAP diet. And it was basically based on the pattern of bloating. And at this stage, I was questioning, was it postprandial? And often with clients and even ourselves, we only think of those symptoms as being there when we ask specifically, and in hindsight we look back and we go, oh yeah, so after that meal I did get significantly bloated, and not with this other type of food. And some of our clients do report eating a healthier diet with more fiber, more whole grains, can make them feel worse, or worse, it's not making them feel any better. So at that stage I encouraged her to do a FODMAP diet under my guidance, and she used the Monash University app, which is a really handy app for busy people, because it's got a huge database that they can just look up when they're eating out or when they're at the supermarket. And there was also the blood sugar balancing aspect, because a lot of kind of low FODMAP foods are white rice and white carbs, and she had to sort of continue with a blood sugar balancing, protein balancing, and good levels of nutritional vegetables, and not just picking low FODMAP foods. So we combined that, and she reported that it made a huge difference, whereas every anti-parasitic that we've done before done nothing but make her worse, and this significantly and very quickly reduced her gut symptoms. So that was kind of the encouragement to do the SIBO test, and suggesting this is supposed to be a short-term diet. If we don't address the root cause, you will still keep getting symptoms until we can find the reason it's happening. So that sort of convinced her to do the SIBO test.
Let's have a look at those test results, and these are from a different lab, but there's no real difference between the labs. They're all using actually quite a lot of, they're normally using the same baseline testing techniques.
Absolutely. So, and both mine and the Quintron technology, so the machine is very
sort of
similar.
Zoom in a little bit there.
Yes, that's
help
helpful.
People see the numbers.
Okay. Yeah, so this is obviously slightly different to Sana. So we performed the SIBO lactulose 3-hour breath test. And you can see here it's positive for hydrogen and for methane gas. So the peak in gas is a lot later than Sana's client. So sort of at the 100-minute mark, it starts to rise as a positive SIBO test.
Yeah, because we should point out this isn't what we're looking at, because that's large intestine.
That's large intestine, yeah.
So as it says there, so it's this particular rise that we're interested in.
Before the transition, within 20 minutes.
Yeah. So that was a positive test.
Absolutely, yeah.
So let's now start talking about what you've done with these test results, because I think this is helpful, isn't it, to people. So Sana, what have you done with your client?
So we picked the biphasic diet as our diet to start sort of building on. I find that's quite helpful in terms of the prescriptive quantities of different types of carbohydrates that are allowed on that diet. I knew my client. I think actually interesting to say at this point, as you were saying earlier on, Helen, we were talking about how we don't want to put sort of extra stress or too much stress on our clients, and sort of build gradually on their capabilities as hopefully the energy is returning. And And, you know, one thing you could possibly say at this point, that of course, you know, you always look back and you think, well, you know, should I have done this test earlier? And in a way, you know, I wish I could immediately just look at somebody and say, okay, these are the tests we need to do. And, you know, this is the fastest way to the sort of end goal. But perhaps, you know, something like the biphasic diet, which is, it's a challenging diet. There's no two ways to sort of describe it, really. Would it have been appropriate and doable? And, you know, would she have been able to execute this diet, you know, when we first started working together? I'm not entirely sure. Whereas now, there certainly was enough of an improvement in her energy already, and she was very motivated to see how this next piece of information was going to kind of fit into the overall picture and how she could hopefully improve from here. So she was,
I think that's a really good point, actually, because, you know, on the whole, when we're working with people with chronic fatigue, it takes time, doesn't it? It's rarely a quick fix. The quickest fix might be 6 months. And, you know, you've got to have energy to do these things. So, you know, it's a vicious circle that hopefully we get to a virtuous circle of getting a bit more energy, and that energy being invested into self-care.
Yeah.
And this is a great way of doing it.
Yeah. And we didn't, just probably helpful to say, because we did talk about histamine earlier on, I didn't pick the sort of histamine-limited biphasic diet, which is even more challenging, I think. Just because she certainly wasn't reacting, you know, when we were doing the sort of histamine food elimination and trial, she basically identified, I think it was tomatoes particularly were a problem for her. And, you know, for many diets, you know, tomatoes are quite often a big feature when you're trying to increase vegetables and making tomato-based, perhaps sort of stews and sauces and so on. And we agreed that just, you know, excluding the tomatoes was hopefully going to be sufficient. And yes, interestingly, we had the 2 week kind of what I'd call a prep phase. So we didn't start antimicrobials immediately, just allowed for the client to sort of get her head around the diet. We made sure that, you know, her digestion was as well supported as possible. She was eliminating daily. We used some herbal, you know, triphala basically to regulate bowel movements to make sure that was happening. And she did pretty much immediately start reporting a lift in terms of her energy levels and just sort of general well-being, which was obviously very, very gratifying for me, and, you know, gave her an awful lot of hope and even more determination to sort of...
It's great, isn't it? I know there's mixed schools about, well, should you do a diet or do you just go in with antimicrobials? Yeah. And to a certain extent, it depends on the client and if they're able to do the diet. But I think when you can do the diet, it starts to give you control.
Yeah.
And I think often, that's so powerful to someone. Okay, yes, they are having to cut out foods, but they are now having control over their body, which they perhaps haven't had for such a long time. And I think that's quite empowering.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we then, after the 2 week period, we picked a combination herbal antimicrobial of sort of 4 different herbs. I think there was berberine, there was some garlic, oregano. So even though she was hydrogen, you know, positive primarily, well, fully, really, there was no methane activity. You know, she has always been someone who sort of wanted to minimize kind of the number of supplements that she's dealing with as well. So I felt, rather than putting in a few different sort of singular herbs, a combination, you know, might be a good idea for her.
Because of course, that's another, we haven't touched on that, but that, you know, is a big focus for a lot of our clients. You know, they can't work or they can only work part-time.
Yeah.
Another reason for doing diet rather than supplements sometimes is the actual expense of the supplements. These, unfortunately, are expensive, aren't they? And out of range of some people, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that's the challenge. There's the sort of the theory and the, you know, gold standard research, and then there's reality.
Day-to-day life, yeah.
I mean, we did, you know, include some biofilm agent, or a biofilm agent as well, but, you know, generally kept it very, very simple.
And what kind of thing would you use for the biofilm?
You could, you know, I think in this case, we literally used N-acetylcysteine, serrapeptase based products I find quite useful at times as well. And again, which what was nice in this client's case was that she tolerated the antimicrobials well, basically, which is not always the case. I think, again, that's the sort of, you know, obviously when you know, when you read the research, you talk, you know, you look at the quantities and you look at the sort of success rates and so on. But again, in real life, I think particularly with our client group of chronic fatigue patients, you know, there's quite a high burden on many of their systems already. And, you know, like in your case, Claire, initially, you know, she really wasn't tolerating things very well. So again, I you know, I do wonder that, you know, had we sort of jumped in earlier, would she have had a rougher journey of it? Who knows? But, you know, in that sense, it was quite nice that,
you know, the prep work had been done, I think, hadn't it, to aid the tolerance.
The foundations had been built. And so we did 6 weeks of the antimicrobial at a full dose pretty quickly. I mean, I always ask clients to build the dose up gradually and, you know, keep in touch with me to make sure that, you know, they're tolerating it okay. And then we did a retest. I don't know if you've got that there, because I think that's kind of interesting to look at as well, because I think that's quite true to real life, perhaps, in some ways. So,
well, can I point out, first of all, this scale is very different.
Yes.
Yeah. The scale on the last one went up to 80, I think it was. Yes, so it looks a little bit similar, but actually it's not, because the scale is a whole different scale.
Yeah. I think so. Probably a good point to remind is in the initial, the peak was at 80 minutes and that was at 68 parts per million. On this one, if you look at 80 minutes, it's 26. So it's, you know, it's more than halved, basically. And, you know, but if I looked at those results sort of without any background story, I would look at them and say, well, you know, this person is positive for hydrogen producing bacteria in their small intestine. However, at this point, the client was really feeling very much better. I mean, in her own words, you know, she pretty much felt she had returned to the energy levels that she'd had, you know, in the past when she felt well. She was socializing, she had rekindled many of her hobbies. You know, she, I mean, in some ways this sounds, it almost sounds a little bit too good to be true, but it really was quite a rapid improvement in this particular case. And so we decided that whilst the results looked still positive, as she was doing so much better, we chose not to go in with another round of antimicrobials, but instead keeping her on prokinetics, doing the meal spacing, so allowing for the migrating motor complex activity between the meals. She at this point was quite happy with the sort of slightly more expanded version of the biphasic diet because she felt very well on it. Interestingly, I suppose one point that is worth making as well, that, you know, we did initially exclude gluten and she felt better on it. We hadn't
off it.
She felt better off it. We had to exclude dairy completely until she started the biphasic diet, and that was the point where the facial puffiness finally went.
Right.
And again, hindsight, perhaps, you know, often we do look at, I think, as in your case, Claire was saying, you know, we take away gluten, dairy, sugar, we sort of do the general clear out. I tend to often do things step by step. So whether it's gluten first or dairy first, and then sort of the other, if there's still a lot of reactivity or a lot of symptoms left. In her case, there, well, apart from that facial puffiness, there wasn't really.
But it's, with dairy, of course, it's interesting, isn't it? Because with the sugar in dairy, the lactose, that, to be broken down in the body, needs lactase, which is a brush border enzyme. Yeah. It's one of those final stages of digestion in the brush borders, which is impacted in SIBO.
Yeah.
So it might be in time she can go back to dairy. You can also have problems with the dairy proteins, and that's a whole different thing. But it might be in time that she, you know, once those brush border enzymes are going, exactly. or even a lactose-free milk might be okay.
Yeah.
But interesting that was her reaction.
Yeah, it was one of those you just think, oh, well, there we go, But, and I think at this point, really, the main concern was that, of course, with the biphasic, and particularly when you're, you know, FODMAP, as FODMAP is one of the sort of bases for the biphasic as well, that there really is a concern that in long-term use, you're sort of lowering your intake of short-chain fermentable, carbohydrates for the microbial colonies in the large intestine. So again, for that very reason, we wanted to look at whether we are able to slowly expand, include more fruit in her diet. We did add, of course, the butyrate just to fuel bacteria in the large intestine. And so far, everything is still going well. I think we've agreed that we'll keep another sort of round of antimicrobials in our back pocket if we need to. May be just something that, you know, but she's very happy to kind of almost learn to live with the level of perhaps SIBO that
there. And I think that's a good, you know, that refers nicely to the Siobhan Sana talk that's been recorded, who goes into SIBO as well in a lot of depth, and she summed it up really well, I think, as saying, you know, for some people SIBO is a full-time job.
Yeah.
At best it's a project. Yeah. And I think that summed it up fairly well. Some people we can get over SIBO completely. In fairness, this is relatively early days. Out of interest, how long have you been working with this lady in total?
So we are in about 2-year mark. So again, yes, I suppose we've sort of skimmed through lots of stages.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's been various different interventions in between as well. But so you can see it's a journey and still continues.
And still continues. But she's, by the sounds of it, doing really, really well. And hopefully won't necessarily be one of those people who has to carry on with the maintenance. Who knows at this stage? It's relatively early days, but our aim is always to get that diet as expanded as possible and the supplements as low as possible. Fantastic. So Claire, how about yours then?
Absolutely. So you were just talking about the dairy tolerance that might sort of improve after. I was just kind of thinking that actually happened with my client, because her observation with periods of cutting out dairy sort of helped her gastrointestinal symptoms, and then introducing them again and gluten again sort of, you know, kind of reactivated her IBS. So what we did was we continued her on a FODMAP diet, and it's just a much more practical option for vegetarians. I think
of course she was vegetarian, wasn't she?
So the biphasic diet's pretty incompatible with a vegetarian, unless you're prepared to eat kind of eggs 6 times a day, and it's very difficult.
And the vegan's almost impossible, but I believe Nirala Jacobi is working on a vegan version, which will be very exciting. Primarily it's around sprouting the seeds and the pulses, so that you effectively use up the carbohydrates.
Pre-digesting. Pre-digesting.
So it may be possible, but until we've really sort of been thinking through
that. And our CFS clients, would you like to sprout for hours and hours? So with this client, she's obviously still working. It's worth noting that her rise in gas was a lot later than some of the other clients that I've seen. So that was possibly why the FODMAP diet worked a bit better for, you know, she was able to carry that out and get improvements from that. And we did make sure we supported her digestion with a really good enzyme that had the disaccharidases in it, so lactase and brush border enzymes. Obviously we know that's often deficient in SIBO, so that we could optimize her absorption and digestion so it wouldn't be fermented later on, and that seemed to sort of have an effect too. I used the FODMAP diet. She just had some pretty adverse reactions to neem and allicin, which we decided to use at that stage. So I referred her to her GP, I wrote a letter, it was obviously referenced with the antibiotics that we often recommend. So it would be rifaximin, metronidazole at the stage, which has the best research in SIBO. The GP contacted a gastroenterologist who happened to be SIBO literate, who did prescribe or recommend rifaximin, but it was deemed too expensive. So this is something that our clients do run into. It's just seen as too expensive a drug to be used, and with not.
And it is, in fairness, it's of all of the antibiotics, it's something like £210 for a course,
in the realm,
which
of
is. That. Considerably more expensive than any other antibiotic.
Yeah, and I think it's just primarily used for encephalitis, and it's not had the body of research to be used widely. So understandably, they tried a course of metronidazole, which didn't help at all, probably because it was absorbed within an hour and rifaximin stays in the small intestine. So she then elected to pay privately for the NHS prescription and got a two-week prescription. She tolerated this so well, you know, really, really well. There's none of the toxicity symptoms she got. You know, it worked really well for this client. So symptoms were reduced, you know, very, very quickly compared to, you know, everything else we've been struggling with for a couple of years. She did later observe an increase of thrush, which is often, you know, the case with multiple antibiotics. So there were some negative side effects with the antibiotics, but we can obviously work with that nutritionally really well. So it was to sort of go ahead, deal with the SIBO. And a prokinetic was a really essential part of the protocol. She was taking citalopram, so that a lot of prokinetic formulations contain 5-HTP, which is contraindicated. So it made it quite difficult for us to pick one.
The prokinetic is there for the migratory motor complex.
Yes.
That's sort of like this wave that sweeps through the gut, taking all of the debris, all of the bacteria that's crept up, taking that back into the large intestine. So that prokinetic is really important to support that function when it's not working as well as it should for some.
Absolutely. And that's thought to be the underlying cause of SIBO in the first place, and that self-sterilizing mechanism that your small intestine had just pretty much shut down. And so we, at the time, there was a herbal blend that was available, which is no longer sort of available in the UK. She did notice it working, and a lot of my clients do report that they can feel, you know, their bowel motions are just much, much more coordinated. So now we did try ginger, give her a bit of a burn, which I think that's pretty
that
common.
Can happen, particularly in SIBO, if there's a lot of rawness higher up.
Absolutely. So acetylcarnitine is working for her at the moment, so we're using that instead. So she tolerated the antibiotics really well. She's feeling much better. So that morning sickness that she had and the morning urgency is pretty much gone. So that's kind of been the significant thing. The bloating's gone, unless there's an occasional bloat related to the size of the meal that she's enjoyed. Energy's good and mood's really stable. So it's interesting to see, you know, before we she came back to sort of address depression and possibility of sort of support coming off her antidepressants, there's a feeling that you know, perhaps she's not needing the medication. So she's going to discuss coming off her antidepressant with her GP supervision. So anxiety is much reduced. Her food tolerance is a lot better. So I sort of mentioned the gluten, dairy, and whilst, you know, some of our clients stay on a gluten-free diet long-term, some people can actually reintroduce it. And with their brush border enzymes, you know, kind of work there at present again, and lactose in particular, she's able to reintroduce without that flare-up. So we're sort of in the early stages of reintroduction at the moment. And I know the Monash University app does have a really good section in the diary portion, which it gives you the amounts that you can sort of titer up with,
so
you
start.
Yeah, it's really helpful. She's still sugar free, so her allergy reactions are much less. So we're working on strengthening her immune system at the moment, obviously supporting the microflora disturbances which would have happened with
exactly. Is she tolerating probiotics? Have you gone down a probiotic route or a Saccharomyces boulardii?
Saccharomyces primarily because of the low secretory IgA, and we're going to work on that sort of the next phase. So we're going to look at foods as well, because we'd like to, you know, the person's not made of money, so we want to use food. It's much more practical, so we're going to slowly build that in.
And fermented foods can be quite good, can't they? We wouldn't use them at the start of SIBO. Particularly when there's a chance of histamine and things around. But of course, the whole point about fermented foods are they are fermented. They were fermentable, but they've now been fermented. So in theory, if they're completely fermented, they should be tolerated. But we wouldn't introduce those at the beginning. We would come in with those later on.
Absolutely. So probably not at the stage, and she's still taking the prokinetic. We are, because she's only had the one round of antibiotics and the sort of semi-round of, the herbals. We're using a low dose timed release oregano. So that's quite useful against both hydrogen, methane and candida. So it's just a very small dosage, but she's...
And great that she's now tolerating that.
I know.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because obviously as nutritional therapists, we can't use antibiotics, which is why we would write to a GP. And on the whole, often the antimicrobials work well for people, but there's a time issue as well as sometimes a reactivity issue. And with the antibiotics, they don't always work. It sounds like it's worked a dream for this lady, but they're not always successful. They're not always successful in the long term. Hence, you have to keep an eye on the diet, and you still continue some support.
You have to take the three-pronged approach. So we did discuss, you know, you could just take antibiotics, or all of research is in single interventions, but combining three interventions which sort of work. I think for SIBO, the FODMAP diet is supposed to have a 50% effectivity rate. But then I said, you know, you combine that with the antimicrobials and the prokinetic, and you've got a much bigger effect. So it seems to be what she has experienced in a much shorter amount of time. So hopefully, you know, keeping the bowel quiet, she's working on that reintroduction of foods, because we do want to expand the diet. You know, there's a lot of things, healthy foods, she'll be missing with, you know, cutting out masses of, you know, fermentable fibers. So hopefully that tolerance will be better.
Brilliant. So two very different cases, really, of the, you know, sort of the direction into SIBO. And I think with yours, a really good example of how there can be problems in both parts of the gut.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it often used to be thought it was all in the large intestine. At the moment, all of the fashion is all about, well, you know, it's all in the small intestine. Actually, you can have things going on in both.
Yeah.
But often if there's something going on in the small intestine, it can stop you getting to address the large intestine. I think, you know, it's likely that a lot of her reactions when you were trying to work out the large intestine were because of the sensitivities in the small intestine, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. And sort of, you know, going back to why we did tests initially, or we didn't think of it earlier, and sort of, you know, there were signs of post-infectious IBS. There were, you know, clues that it might be SIBO, but it was quite important to lay sort of the groundwork of blood sugar stability, because that actually allowed her to increase her energy reserves. And we really worked on supporting her detox and elimination before trying to attempt, you know, what's required of SIBO, and the lifestyle elements like meal spacing probably wouldn't be possible with a client, you know, that if we'd found it earlier and attempted that protocol, it could have been resulted in a much worsening of her chronic fatigue.
It's another great example, I think, of how it takes time, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Brilliant. So, Sana, Claire, anything else that you want to share? Anything we've not covered in your two cases? I think we've just about covered everything, haven't we?
Yeah.
So, I think
we've covered it all. And even, the hindsight, you know, and I think that's the sort of part of self-auditing anyway for any practitioner looking back. And I think for both of us, it is that interesting. Even if we had perhaps thought of SIBO earlier on, would it have been the right time for it? We just won't know.
We won't know, but probably you've still got to do that groundwork, haven't you?
Yeah, exactly.
And if SIBO is the only thing going on for someone, then perhaps, yes, you dive in.
Yeah.
But actually with what can happen from SIBO, because everything starts in the gut, with, you know, how it ripples out to all of the functions in the body, probably there's a lot of preparation work would need to be done for most people.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much. And I hope everyone has enjoyed your two case studies today.